Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented free of charge by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You're about to hear neurologist Oliver Sacks, the poet laureate of medicine and author of Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain, in conversation with Ara Guzalemian, provost and dean of the Juilliard School. Sacks examines the complexities of our response to music and the particular powers of music to move us physically and emotionally, beneficially or destructively, showing how we humans are a musical species no less than a linguistic one. This program was originally produced on October 23, 2007. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
We were just speaking about growing up, and music was, has been, and continues to be a thread in your life from the very beginning. Talk a little about the role of music in your family's life early on and how all of that might have eventually led to the work that is in front of us.
Well, the house was full of music. My father was very musical. He always had little miniature orchestral scores on his person, and between seeing patients, he would sort of pull these out. I think he almost despised record players because he had something in his head quite as good as any record player. So he played the piano. My elder brothers played. We had a music teacher, Ticciati, who adored Bach, and really the house was full of Bach when I grew up. When I was 5 or 6, I was asked what were my favorite things in the world, and I said Bach and smoked salmon. I had smoked salmon at lunch today, and 70 years later, it hasn't changed that much. I think I'm probably one of the less musical members of the family, but certainly I was immersed in music from my earliest memories.
You have written in a past book, A Leg to Stand On, very movingly about how a specific musical experience actually was transformative unexpectedly, and you recall that in this book. Would you talk about what happened?
It was back in 74. I had an accident, damaged one of my legs a good deal, it was on a mountain, I was alone, I was lucky to be saved. I was brought back and operated on, but the leg was paralyzed and numb and really didn't feel as if it was part of me. And when it seemed to be sufficiently recovered, I was stood up and told to walk. And basically, I had forgotten how to walk, or at least walking did not come in the spontaneous, automatic way, which it should be. And I sort of moved the leg gingerly, and at one point it got in the way of the other leg. And then suddenly, in the 2 weeks I'd been in the hospital room, there was scaffolding outside, so there was no radio reception, but a friend of mine, Jonathan Miller, had brought me in a tape recorder with a single cassette, which was the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, and I was playing that almost day and night, and suddenly it came into my mind with almost the force of hallucination, and as that happened, I found myself walking with it, and movement was synchronized with the sound. This is what I had seen years before with my Parkinsonian patients, the awakenings patients who couldn't move unless they had music. And now, although the physiology was somewhat different, I think exactly this was happening to me, this uniquely human response to the beat and the rhythm of music, which is to move with it.
Even the act of rescuing yourself had a kind of musical impetus to get down from the mountain, didn't it?
Right, yeah. The leg was out of action and sort of as floppy as a piece of spaghetti. I'd torn all the muscles off the thigh. And I splintered the leg after a fashion. I had an umbrella, which I'd been using as a walking stick, and I tore my anorak in two and sort of heaved myself down like this. But it was rather hard and clumsy until rhythm and song came to me, which in particular the Volga Boatman song, and yo heave ho, and each heave. And this way, instead of sort of muscling myself down, I musicked myself down, and it became joyous and easy and coordinated. I mean, it's true that I didn't think I would survive the day, but at that point, motion itself was made so easy and coordinated by music. And I know a lot of athletes who either have iPods or use musical imagery to invigorate and coordinate them in the same way. I certainly do in swimming, which I love, and the 1-2-3 of swimming. I am 1-2-3. 1-2-3 turns into a Strauss waltz. I swim to Strauss, but I came down the mountain to the Volga Boatman.
One of the most moving themes in the book, and it appears in many ways, is this kind of transformative pulling out of oneself, dare one say, healing effect of music, and how it manifests itself in very different ways. You talk about it in the book in a number of ways. One is with profound memory loss or eventually dementia. So I want to ask you to tell us about Woody Geist and the Grunions, because that's one remarkable case that you discuss in the book.
I got a letter, and so much of the book has come from letters I've received and then seeing the people. I got a letter from Woody Geist's daughter telling me that her father had had Alzheimer's for 13 years and that he was now in bad shape. He couldn't remember what he had done for a living. He didn't know where he was. He couldn't remember anything for more than a few seconds. He couldn't dress himself. But, she said, he remembers the baritone part of every song he has ever sung. And he had sung for 40 years with an a cappella group in sort of jazz harmony. And she went on to say that even though he was profoundly confused and demented, when he sang, it was perfect, and that he had been singing just recently at the RKO Music Hall. And a couple of months later, I met Woody with his wife and daughter, and the three of them sang together. And my consulting room is not usually full of music. But it was absolutely enchanting, and sort of neighbors listened outside the door. And so Woody was part of this group, the Grunions, and although he'd been devastated in every other way, he was really perfectly preserved musically. And when he, and this was not just a mechanical thing, I mean, one there was sensibility and intelligence and tact, humor, tenderness, everything was still there when he performed. And although 5 seconds later he would have no memory of having sung, but this brought home to me so overwhelmingly the absolute difference between different sorts of memory, how the memory for events, for one's own life, how one's autobiographic memory can go, and the memory of facts and things can go, but not the memory of procedures, of performance. I've seen this in recently I saw this in another way with a great actor who is actually amnesic, but his consummate acting skills and his huge Shakespearean repertoire are still there. He is completely himself as an actor and not there, you know, in any other way.
Another astonishing case study, and a very extensive one, is of Clive, is it Waring?
Yeah, Clive Waring.
Waring, an English musicologist with amnesia so profound that it's nothing longer than 5 seconds ago is remembered. There's a kind of value sometimes placed on living in the moment, but his is almost a condemnation to nothing but living in the moment with no recollection of anything even 30 seconds prior, and of people and of conversations. He was an enormously accomplished musicologist and pianist and conductor, I think.
And singer.
And singer, and as a result of a brain infection, had this profound amnesia. But maybe you could pick up the tale there, that there was some remarkable retention of his musical knowledge.
This is very beautifully shown in a film which was made by Jonathan Miller, directed by him, called Prisoner of Consciousness, which was made in 1986. And there again, in a way, as with Woody, you see, although Clive is a highly intelligent and charming man and has not lost, you know, any of his mental faculties as Woody has, his autobiographic memory is completely gone. I mean, so much so that he, Proust describes a time of waking up in an unfamiliar room, not knowing where one is or what's going on, or even who one is, and how memory comes down like a rope let down from heaven to pull one out of the abyss of unbeing. Now, that abyss yawns under Clive all the while, and it produces sudden panic, so he kept feeling he was dead. He'd only just awoken. He has no continuity in his life, but what you see in what Jonathan's film showed so beautifully was how he could conduct an orchestra or a choir with enormous sensitivity and professionalism and mastery. And more than 20 years later, this really remains the case. He has lost everything, or almost everything in a way, except music, but then music becomes everything for him. And when he's in the moment in music, he's totally himself. But perhaps performing music doesn't require memory in the ordinary sense, in the way that every bar and every note is organically connected to the rest and sort of comes from what preceded it and points to what will go on. I mean, the law of music, the momentum of music, sort of holds him.
There's something you call procedural memory, which is a kind of memory of a repetitive action, which many musicians have. But from your descriptions, the expressive content, the emotional content is also there. It's much more than a kind of mechanical repetition of a somehow memorized gesture.
Absolutely. I don't feel we have an adequate concept. I mean, one uses the term procedural memory, say, for the memory of walking, you know, of action of one sort and another, but not of, you know, artistic performance of this caliber.
But the content and the response to the content is somehow intact.
Yeah,
it's not a kind of savant repetition.
No, and indeed, although he cannot remember ever having played before, he will in fact bring spontaneity and innovation to everything he plays. It's always new.
The other thing that I found very moving about that chapter is you describe in the film, which is in the mid-80s, soon after the profound memory loss, that he was rather traumatized in spirit, and you met him just 2 or 3 years ago, so 20 years after that fact, and the man you met was, describe him, certainly not broken in spirit.
No, one crucial thing which had held him together, I think, was his wife's love and devotion. I mean, they had been madly in love at the time and just married a few weeks before he got the encephalitis. And since he has no sense of time, he is still madly in love. In fact, they are still madly in love. And his wife wrote a wonderful memoir, which in the subtitle of this is Love and Amnesia. But he has also become very, very talkative and very sociable. And one topic follows another very quickly. So there's not time for him to fall into the abyss. I mean, when I got there, you know, he was told just before the door opened that I was coming. And he immediately said, hello, doctor. You doctors work 24 hours a day, and sort of burst into things, and I could hardly get a word in. But he keeps a sort of continuity by hopping from one topic to another and by constant conversation. And he's funny and quite resourceful when his memory fails him. So he kept not recognizing me. When I went to lunch with him and with the two of them, and I'd been sitting next to him in the car, but he forgot that. And 5 seconds later, he saw me and said, are you joining us? And their sort of forgetfulness and courtesy and resourcefulness and humor, they all came together. So he's a very charming man, but it's so tragic. And yet, when you hear him perform, all the magic's there.
And the other piece of the magic is the response to his wife, that although each experience is new, you write that there's a calming and reassuring presence, that somehow some understanding or memory of her love for him remains constant between visits.
Right. I mean, she is really the only, beside music, the only rope from heaven which will pull him out of the abyss.
Is there a physiological explanation for why music somehow remains intact despite various illnesses and traumas? Is it different parts of the brain, or is music more widely placed in the brain?
It is very widely placed. There's no one music center. There's sort of 20 or 30 different networks in the brain which separately analyze pitch and timbre and rhythm and melodic contour and put it all together. And individual bits of this can be knocked out. But once the system is established, it's very, very robust and then becomes largely lodged in primitive parts of the brain, called the basal ganglia and the cerebellum, parts which are below the cerebral cortex, so that then if you have a devastating cortical disease, as Woody has, you know, music is sort of in the strong box of the subcortex. You know, I feel it's very, very good to, if you're a musician, it won't be quite as bad if you become demented.
Well, and there is the astonishing fact in the book that a musician's brain over time is actually visibly different.
Yeah, this is astounding work done by a man called Schlaug, Gottfried Schlaug at Harvard, who has been looking at doing MRIs and brain imaging, looking at the shape and the development of the brain in musicians and non-musicians, actually usually in three groups of professional musicians, amateur musicians, and non-musicians. And he's had a series of papers. One in 95 showed that the corpus callosum, this big band of white matter between the two hemispheres, is enlarged in musicians. And then there were similar findings with regard to the auditory parts of the brain, the motor parts of the brain, and many other parts of the brain. And these are actually visible to the naked eye. If you look at a brain, you can't say this is the brain of a mathematician or a writer or a visual artist, but you can probably say, I think this is the brain of a musician. And even with a single year of intensive musical training, you know, as with the Suzuki method, you have visible changes. So the brain is very plastic and very malleable, but it seems to respond to music almost more than to anything else.
One other stunning thing about music and memory that I learned from the book is something you describe, which is the way repeat that there sometimes isn't a distinction, at least measurably, between actually hearing a piece of music and thinking that piece of music, if it's familiar to you, that's actually sometimes measurably the same, and that's astounding to me. That the activity in the brain maps the same if you're actually listening to a piece of music as if it's a piece you know well. You simply think of
absolutely, and I think imagining listening to a piece of music is a sort of inaction, and imagining it is a sort of playing, and even this essentially human business of keeping time to music one way and another is internal as well. Even if one doesn't visibly keep time, the brain is keeping time. And when one imagines music, the musical parts of the brain become activated. You can see this in functional brain imagery. And this new brain imagery is so exciting because you can actually visualize people listening to music, the nature of their attention, or imagining music, or composing music, or being given musical phrases and playing with them.
This ability to print or retain music can go wrong, very badly wrong as well, and can become a kind of source of torment. One experience which must be common to virtually everyone is the classic experience of having a tune, often a silly tune or a terribly banal tune, unshakably stick in your head.
Especially a silly tune.
And that's a common neurological phenomenon.
It is. I suspect it's universal. I think we all have, even the least musical among us, I think we all tend to have tunes going through our head. Sometimes one's scarcely aware of this and you realize something has been going through your head for half an hour. But usually, it will have some meaning, and you can say it was stimulated by a thought, a memory, by seeing something. It goes with a mood, it goes with an activity. And I think there's a sort of, you know, a meaningful background of imagined music, you know, almost throughout life, with probably with most of us, but sometimes, as you say, this goes wrong. And instead of this rich, varied background, a single piece, or maybe a few bars from it, gets into a loop and goes round and round, and you can't stop it. And you may do all sorts of things. A friend of mine was infuriated by a silly song from a television show. It was just the theme song. And he said it went on with him for 10 days, hundreds of times a day. It interfered with his schoolwork, his peace of mind, his sleep. He said he jumped up and down. He slapped his face. He threw cold water over himself. He couldn't stop it. Finally, he said it faded after 10 days. But then, as he was telling me, it came back. But our susceptibility to music, I think, it can, you know, is almost excessive. I don't know that this sort of looping, it happens a little to some extent with words, but I think to nothing like the extent it happens with music. And if you do functional brain imaging, you can almost see this whirlpool of activity going round and round. And and it's contagious. There's a Mark Twain story which he wrote in the 1870s about a jingle which infects someone, and he finds his feet keeping time, and finally he confesses this to a priest, and then the priest is infected. And when the priest tells the story to his congregation, all of them are, you know, sometimes these earworms, as the music industry calls them, are, you know, they've been called sort of music contagious musical viruses. But it's, we are immensely sensitive to music, and it can go overboard, I think, that way.
We were talking when we met earlier this evening, I was talking about an extremely beautiful Bach cantata, and asking Dr. Sachs if he knew that one, and its German title is Ich habe genug, and I will let Dr. Sachs continue the story because it ended up having not the most positive association.
It is one of the most beautiful and spiritual of the cantatas, but it came to my mind repetitively when I was, I kept adding footnotes and bits to musicophilia, and I was getting thoroughly sick of it, and I felt I'd had enough. Ich habe genug means I have enough. It means this in the most spiritual way, but for me it just came to me saying, you know, I've had it, you know, stop it. And but there, you know, the mind selected a cantata, deformed the meaning a little bit, and then, you know, and then it sort of really was my unconscious speaking to me, I think.
In the introduction, Louise Steinman referred to a very moving portion of the book in which you talk about how a chance hearing of music of Schubert coming through a basement window was the beginning of coming to terms in some ways with a terrible personal loss, your mother's death. But what was equally fascinating is sometime after that, in a sense, you consciously tried to recreate it by seeking Schubert, and it had the opposite effect.
It didn't work. I somehow thought of Schubert as a lifeline. And when I heard that Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau was going to be in New York and singing one of the song cycles, the Winterreise, I was desperate to get in. The place was full, but I managed to get a ticket for $100, which was a huge amount then, and also much more than I can afford. But you know, $100 for a life, that's okay. But when I got there, it didn't work. I seemed to sit stonily, but I thought that Fischer-Dieskau then was no good. I thought he's had it. He's lost it. And although I saw appearances of being deeply moved in the people all around me, I thought, you know, they're not really moved. But they were, and he was marvelous. But at that point, sort of, you know, what Ibsen called the coldness of the heart had taken over again. I couldn't let the music in; it wouldn't let me in, and it showed me that you can't order up music. You can't order a response. It has to come as a sort of grace.
And perhaps sometimes that might explain why in people with various profound illnesses or mental impairments that the musical response is so intuitive and deep, because it bypasses in some way any attempt to control the response. You talk, and in a number of cases, if I can ask you about the effect it's had with people who deal with various syndromes, Tourette's, for example, there's an astonishing tale you tell of a drum circle, which would seem so counterintuitive.
In Tourette's syndrome, there are sudden movements and noises which are not synchronized and as it were, not musical, not rhythmical. And I a few months ago in New York, I went to this amazing event, this drum circle, where there were 30 people with Tourette's syndrome, all sort of jerking and ticking and barking in their own way, all rather isolated and, as it were, enclosed within their own Tourette's. And then the leader of this was a man himself with very severe Tourette's, who was only liberated from Tourette's in the act of drumming, in the act of making music. And when he started, the others started to join in. And as they did so, they lost the abrupt, unsynchronized movements. And they all became sort of synchronized drummers. And it was wonderful to see this. And one saw, really, I think, the primal power and role of rhythm, which is to synchronize people with each other and to synchronize different parts of the brain with each other. And I think this is a uniquely human thing, but it was spectacular with people with Tourette's, as with people with Parkinson's.
A condition on a very different, with very different manifestations, is Williams, and perhaps you can explain what that is for those who aren't familiar, and what role music has had in the Williams patients you've seen.
This is a very rare congenital syndrome. It's not hereditary, it's mutation. It affects maybe one person in 20,000. It was Williams himself was a cardiologist who described this in the 1960s, because some of the people had cardiac defects and other physical problems. But what is extraordinary is the mental profile and personality of people with Williams syndrome, in that they tend to be, well, they are invariably very sociable, very outgoing, very voluble, very talkative, and in love with music. Many of them are musically talented, but all of them are enraptured by music. I first saw this sort of, en masse back in 1995 when I visited there was a special place in Massachusetts which had a sort of music course for people with Williams syndrome, and there were 50 people there. They had a considerable physical similarity. They almost looked like members of a tribe or a family, but it was the mental similarity which was so extraordinary, and all of them are in love with music. Whereas other powers are very diminished. People with Williams syndrome are retarded. They tend to have an IQ of 50 or 60. They can't tie their shoelaces. They can't make change. They can't cross the road safely. They can't lead independent lives. But verbally and musically, they can be extraordinary. And you find that the auditory parts of the brain and the verbal and musical parts of the brain are very well preserved and often enlarged, and the other parts of the brain are quite small. And so there's an extreme difference here. And but it's especially, I think, the emotional response. I mean, people with Williams cannot hold themselves from weeping, from laughing, from rapture, from agony, from ecstasy. In a way, I think a composer would be delighted at their transparency and their susceptibility. And one finds again, if one does functional brain imaging, that there's almost no part of the brain which doesn't get activated when they listen to music.
But in a way, the disinhibition, if you will, or the lack of that sort of controlling part of the brain allows this wholehearted embrace of the experience. And in some ways, it sounds enviable in the ability to embrace
it. But it's also sort of dangerous, because people with Williams are entirely innocent and trusting. And they, I saw this with a little girl working with at one time, and she kept going up to strangers, and her mother would say, "Don't speak to strangers." And the girl said, "They're not strangers, they're all friends. The whole world consists of friends." This was an amazingly self-possessed little girl. I became almost speechless when I saw her, and she said, "Don't be shy, Mr. Sachs." And it's very strange having a retarded five-year-old, have to telling one not to be shy.
You quote in the introduction to the book a wonderful image from a story of Arthur C. Clarke in which aliens land and see the phenomenon of a concert, and they can't make heads or tails of what this human experience is. And you've also spoken on other occasions of perhaps having a similar alien experience yourself in attending a Grateful Dead concert. And at the same time, there's something profound in that non-functional communal experience of music. Is that is that fundamental, and is it perhaps unique to humans? Is this a defining trait?
I think so. Although animal lovers, sometimes object to this notion. I mean, you never see a chimpanzee dancing or chimpanzees dancing together. It is true that there is the Thai elephant orchestra, so-called. Elephants who have great big brains, four times as big as a human brain, they have remarkable memories and skills of many, many sorts. But an elephant can be trained with its trunk to beat a drum with great precision at, say, 72 beats a minute. I mean, more accurately and consistently than a human drummer. But the other elephants will not synchronize. They will all beat drums in their own way, and really the elephant orchestra is a cacophony.
Is the musicophilia of the title a defining human trait?
I'm inclined to think that it is, although there's some others who express themselves in rather negative terms. William James, whom I adore generally, and I continually read and reread his Principles of Psychology, but in this 1,500 pages, he has one sentence, and that dismissive, if not derisive, about music. He says that it has no zoological utility, it corresponds to nothing in the external world, it's a pure incident of having a hearing organ, he says, like the susceptibility to seasickness. End of quote. For some reason, there's almost no reference to music in either the works or the biographies of either of the James brothers. One can certainly sort of find negative things in his autobiography. In Nabokov, in Speak Memory, says that music for him is no more than, he says, an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating noises. But I think that the vast majority of people, unless there is something organically the matter, can hardly help themselves responding emotionally to music any more than they can help themselves responding motorically. And music may indeed you can't have a musical table or a musical bottle, but I think there's no emotion of which people are capable which can't be evoked by music. And I think music can also evoke states of mind, ideas, moods, I don't know what word to use, which cannot be expressed in any other way and which are ineffable. And in this way, I think we need music and turn to it as much as we need language. I think we're a musical species and mostly with a very positive way. Curiously, you won't find musicophilia in the dictionary, although you will find musicophobia, which is actually, I confess, what I feel to some of Wagner. Which Nietzsche did as well. Nietzsche, of course, Nietzsche and Wagner were very close originally, and then there was a separation. Maybe this was partly Nietzsche's anger, but in one of his late books, he talks about what he calls the pathological in music. And he says this is degeneration of the sense of rhythm, and music which becomes endless melody, the polypus in music. And for him, Wagner and the Liebestod sort of exemplifies that. Incidentally, for this very reason, Wagner is no good for people with Tourette's or Parkinson's. It doesn't have enough rhythmic muscle.
You've also make reference in the book about the dangers of the over-availability of music, which increasingly is a phenomenon in modern life. I was wondering if you could talk about that. Music clutter, in a sense.
Yeah. Maybe it started with Muzak in elevators, but I don't know how it is in Los Angeles. In New York, you can't get away from it. Every restaurant, every bar, every gym, every mall. And if you ask for the music to be softened or turned off, people take this as an offense, you know, as if you were impugning their creativity. And you can't close your ears as you can close your eyes. And music bores into one all the while. And then, of course, again in New York, 90% of people are plugged in to iPods. Although I think there's something absolutely wonderful about having the whole world of music available in a matchbox, and yet there's a real danger of, first, I think, of having it too loud, and there's really the beginning of a huge epidemic, I think, of juvenile deafness, and people turn up the stereo in order to obliterate the environment, and they do so successfully that they walk in front of cars and things. I mean, New York, at least, is full of zombies, of people who are totally, totally engrossed in... I mean, it's lovely to be engrossed in music in a concert. It's not so good when you're crossing 42nd Street. And I do wonder whether sort of things like these earworms and repetitive music and even musical hallucinations may be becoming commoner because of this.
You've just reminded me of an experience in a restaurant. It was here in Los Angeles, actually. I find I can't not listen. I can't switch it off. My ear goes to it, and I begin to overload because my ear is so drawn to whatever is playing that I can't concentrate on a conversation or whatever else I'm doing. But I was once in a restaurant here which had this kind of hellish tape going on of great climactic passages from pieces, one after the other, you know, sort of the end of the Liebestod from Wagner's Tristan, followed by the climax of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, followed by, you know, a minute snippet, and it was, it was some sort of purgatory of exhaustion. And it's hard not to listen.
Yeah, no, it's exactly the same. And I mean, I think people have no right to impose music on one. You know, there really is a sort of music pollution, like all the other pollutions around.
And music, in some ways, is dependent on silence. You need the existence of silence for the existence of music to be meaningful.
And certainly quietness. No, that's very, very funny about this sequence of climaxes. Yeah, you can.
We want to turn in for the next 20 or 25 minutes or so to questions from you for Oliver Sacks. And if you can give us a second to get a microphone to you. Justin, who is standing there, has the microphone. How about we begin with the lady who's closest to you, Justin? And give me a second also to repeat the question.
Do people who can't carry a tune or clap in time to music have some kind of brain abnormality?
Do people who can't carry a tune or somehow can't clap to music have some sort of brain abnormality?
Well, By the way, I couldn't hear you there. I don't know whether you were too close to the microphone or whether this is my own hearing impairment, which is sort of getting worse and worse. It depends how you... I think there is a normal variation, and about 5 to 10% of the population have difficulty carrying a tune, although they may love music and also love singing. We all have neighbors who sing joyfully to their own delight in the bath and almost unbearably. There was a cantor in our local synagogue at one point when I lived in a city island, an almost tone-deaf cantor, who greatly fancied there are certain cantillations which consist of very elaborate tonal excursions with frills and you have to have a tonal center. You have to come back home, and he would end up half an octave away. And I sort of went out howling like Munch's scream in a sort of acoustic agony. But there is now you won't really pick up anything pathological in people like this, but something which is pathological, if you want, and very rare, is absolute amusia, or an inability to really to perceive or recognize any music, and indeed to have a concept of music. I first encountered a little bit of this with a colleague, a French neurologist called Lhermitte, and he mentioned to me that when he listened to music, he could either say it was the Marseillaise or it wasn't. I mean, that was it. Unfortunately, I forgot to ask him how he knew it was the Marseillaise. I suspect he would have said it was because people stood up or saluted. But I've spent quite a lot of time with a fascinating, intelligent, sensitive woman who has this congenital amusia. In her recollection, it goes right back to her earliest years, and she got rather tormented at school. If she had been stone deaf, people would have understood, but she was perfectly sensitive to ambient sounds, to bird singing, to sinks gurgling, and to people's speech, but she seemed deaf to music. She came from a musical family, and her mother said, "What have you got against music?" She forced herself to go to concerts, although, as she said, she found it somewhere between unintelligible and excruciating. When she was fairly young, a family friend tested her and found that she just couldn't tell whether one note was higher or lower than another, unless they were very widely separated. So with someone like this lady, there's no perception of tones or semitones, of the building blocks of music. Now, a few years ago, she saw an article in the New York Times about some workers in Canada who seemed to be looking at a condition like her own, and she contacted them, and they came and saw her, and they confirmed that she had a real neurological amusia. It was not a neurotic one. She had nothing against music. It was a neurological one, and it went with an anomaly, an anatomical anomaly, in part of the right frontal lobe. And she said, "Am I the only person in the world like this?" And they said, "No, there are a few others." And they introduced her to some of her brothers and sisters in amusia. And they also gave her a piece of advice. They said, "You don't have to go to concerts anymore." They said, "If your husband cajoles you, say, 'You go, I'll go to a movie.'" And she says she only wishes she had been given that advice when she was 7 rather than 70. But she was sort of wistful and curious about music for a while, but she has a very full life. But this is a very rare situation.
Let's go to this side of the room if you can get your exercise, Justin.
I was wondering if this kind of quasi-autonomic memory, if there was any differentiation between performative music or musicology or composition or sound design. Was there any more or less retention between them, or is it strictly motions of hands and?
Let me paraphrase the question. Is there a distinction between those in different disciplines of music, like musicology and performance? Is it a kind of a motor memory, or is there a more comprehensive kind of musical memory that kicks in people of different music disciplines? Does a musicologist, in a way, remember music in a different way than a pianist remembers music? Is that a fair translation?
I would certainly think so. Anyone, I think, who has learned an instrument will have it in their hands, or if they're a singer, in their voice for the rest of their life. You know, one speaks here of muscular memory or something like this. But clearly, if you have studied, what should we say, a Beethoven symphony, you will have an intellectual and an analytical knowledge of it and of the laws which govern it and of the work which went into it, which a mere player may not have. And so there's every form of musical knowledge and skill. Of course, one of the things about poor Clive, was, you know, he had both of these to a very great degree. He was a grand performer and an extraordinary sort of encyclopedic musicologist. But different aspects can be knocked out with damage. Sometimes this has especially been described in conductors who have had strokes, mercifully rare, but sometimes a stroke in the left hemisphere of the brain will knock out the intellectual understanding, the perception of the structure of music, but leave the emotional response fully intact. And a stroke affecting the right hemisphere may have the opposite effect. In general, sort of naive listeners, and I'm a naive listener, you're a skilled one, for most of us, the right hemisphere is predominantly involved. But in musicologists and trained musicians and high-level performers, then all of the analytical skills of the left hemisphere come in as well.
Can we do a detour for a second? Because you reminded me of something else extraordinary in the book, which is full of such extraordinary, vivid passages. Your mother, who I think was a physician, self-diagnosed on the basis of a memory. Could you tell us about that?
My mother had difficulty holding a tune and was a little tone deaf, although she loved music and actually she loved singing. And in retrospect, as I think back, I'm almost moved to tears at the memory of her slightly off-key voice singing various Schubert Lieder. But when she was 75, though still working as a surgeon and quite intact, she had an odd experience. And she said that she had woken one morning with songs from the Boer War going through her mind. She had been 7 at the time of this conflict. And then, you know, there were a lot of patriotic songs were being sung in England. She said that she didn't think these songs had meant anything to her. She'd never given any conscious thought to them. She didn't think they were in her memory, but now they were just effervescing. And she sang some of them. I made a sort of recording. She had the words. And she was very puzzled at the sudden eruption of memory. And, you know, she'd had neurological training herself. She wondered if she'd had a little stroke or whether some medication she was taking for high blood pressure was causing this. But this involuntary imagery, which was almost a hallucination, lasted a few days and then died down. But other people can get extremely overwhelming musical hallucinations which often are immediately thought to be external in origin. Think, you hear that? What's that? No, a hallucination is not like imagery. With imagery, it's your own. A hallucination seems to be autonomous, and it can be very loud, like 100 decibels. Musical hallucination is especially common in people who are losing their hearing. And sometimes a further critical loss of hearing can bring this on. And I think this is because the brain has to be active. And if the auditory parts of the brain are not getting the input they hunger for, then they will sort of reach down and into memory and regurgitate music. But these hallucinations, and people can be very frightened when they have them, you know, it's something unprecedented, uncontrollable, and the notion is I'm hearing things, I must be crazy. And many, many people have musical hallucinations but don't mention it to anyone. I mean, one of the first things one needs to do as a physician is to reassure people that these are not psychotic, that they're not in the least like voices which accuse or humiliate or persecute, and that even if they don't go away, which they may, one can live with them and even feel somewhat at home with them. It's a long story, but I will simply say I've had contact with literally hundreds of people who have musical hallucinations. At first, most of them will use rather mechanical metaphors. They will say it's like having, one of my correspondents said he thought he had an intracranial jukebox. He couldn't stop it playing, although he could switch from one of the 20 selections to another one, provided there was some similarity of rhythm or melody or theme. The metaphors go with technology. When people had these in the 1890s, they had a music box in their head, and now they have an iPod. Sometimes the music seems to have very little relation to one, but just to be music which was popular when one was young. Occasionally the music can be terrifying. I had one patient who was heard Nazi marching songs, and as a Jewish boy growing up in Hamburg in the 1930s, terrified of the Hitlerjugend, and then this was replaced by Tchaikovsky, which was easier to take, although he called it slushy. I asked him originally about his hallucinations. I said, what do you hear? And he said he heard music, he said, which was tonal and corny. I thought this was a very odd choice of adjectives, but he said his wife was a composer of atonal music and his adult tastes were all for Schoenberg and atonal music. But one can learn to live with these, and sometimes I think the hallucinations can become more and more integrated into one's life and personality, and they can become meaningful, like dreams. And one of the subjects I quote in my book, a very eminent psychoanalyst who lives here in Los Angeles, Leo Rangel, is in fact writing a book which I think will be an extraordinary and tender and penetrating analysis of his own musical hallucinations.
Gentleman right here. Right here, yep.
Given the universality of music, I'm curious what role music plays or doesn't play for the congenitally deaf community.
The short version of the question is, what role does music play for the you've got me doing it. Earworm, congenitally deaf community.
Deaf people, congenitally deaf people who have never heard sound and cannot conceive sound can nonetheless be immensely sensitive to vibration and to rhythm. and rhythmic sense may be very, very strong. And if you go to Gallaudet University, you find a jukebox or whatever played at huge intensity, at deafening intensity, but the deaf people will put a hand on it and feel the vibration and love it. And in fact, there's a famous deaf percussionist, Evelyn Glenning, who is, you know, one of the world's greatest. In terms of tonality, I knew a congenitally deaf woman who worked as a therapist at our hospital who could put her hand on a piano keyboard and say, that's a fifth. And she could also recognize, you know, a Chopin mazurka or whatever. And the sense of touch and of vibration can become very, very refined. And so there are quite a number of deaf people who enjoy music, even though it is soundless for them.
Lady in the back row here. Just here in the stripes.
A comment and a question. Whenever I have an earworm, I find that the solution is to go home and play other music that I like loud and replace it. And for some reason, the earworm goes away and it's not replaced by another song. But my question is, essentially, this is the question. Could you name some of your desert island discs?
Could you name some of your desert island discs?
Well, I was asked to do this recently, and I just got into a delirium of adding things and canceling things, and I forget what I did. I'm both broad and narrow. That's to say, I am confined to Western music between 1600 and 1950. And I would like sort of Monteverdi Vespers at one end and Petrushka or Yenufa at the other end. I adore the heartbroken, heartbreaking, slow movements of Mozart, piano and violin concertos. As I said earlier, I'm a Bach lover. I adore the Chaconne in D minor. I think perhaps partly because when I was 10 or so, Yehudi was the first time I'd ever seen or heard a great performer in the flesh. Yehudi Menuhin came to London and he played it. I'm a Mendelssohn lover, and I keep discovering how great Mendelssohn is. We were just talking earlier, and I said how a few weeks ago there's an amazing conductor, David Randolph, in New York, who's in his 90s but has the energy and nimbleness of a 20-year-old, and he conducted an amazing performance of Mendelssohn's Walpurgisnacht. And then and there, I decided I wanted that if I was on a desert island. I really don't know. My tastes shift, but there would always be some Bach and some Mozart and some Brahms and some Mendelssohn and some Stravinsky and some Janáček, but no Wagner.
Let's go all the way to the back row, the lady with... Give us a second.
I'm curious about the physiology of the thrill you feel listening to music sometimes and how it changes from a thrill up my arms, a thrill down my legs, a thrill kind of around my back. What is the physiology of this?
The question is, what is the physiology of a musical thrill? Is it located in different places?
Yes, indeed. A Canadian researcher called Zator has especially investigated this. He himself, like many of the neuroscientists of music, is a musician himself, and knows music from the inside as well as sort of observing it, you know, in people from the outside. But he has done, again, functional brain imaging on people as they get what he calls chills. You call it thrills, he calls it chills. It's the same thing. This is music which makes the hair rise on your forearms or your back, which makes you shiver with a sort of ecstasy or terror. He has shown that this activates what are sometimes called the reward systems of the brain. There's certain deep nuclei of the brain which are also activated when one falls in love, at orgasm, with certain drugs. So he's really shown that music can be a peak experience in which the sensory system and motor and autonomic and everything is turned on to a sort of maximal extent. And this, incidentally, is what occurs, you know, on an almost daily basis in people with Williams syndrome.
Let's do one more. I shouldn't call him Louise. How about right here in the front row?
Oh, thank you very much. All your illustrations have been classical, and especially going back to the beginning of the conversation and the amnesia patients. I wonder if you have had any experience with different kinds of music, like jazz.
The question has to do with virtually all the experiences we've talked about refer to classical music, and if you've had experiences with patients with different kinds of music, for example, jazz.
Experiences with patients or personal experiences?
With patients.
With patients. I think the simple answer is not enough. And this is partly because I tend to work in old age homes and in geriatric institutions and with people whose background, like my own, is more in classical music. But I would think that whatever applies to classical music may apply equally well to any other mode of music, whether it's jazz or Hindu music or whatever. I mean, and certainly, specifically, I think people with Tourette syndrome, I know several of them who are extraordinary jazz improvisers, and jazz may sort of appeal to these energized, impulsive people very specially. Although having said that, there's also a great sort of classical or neoclassical composer, Tobias Picker, who has Tourette's, and in him you find every sort of pastoral and lyrical mood, as well as the tumultuous. I haven't had and haven't sort of, you know, been told of. I just haven't had sufficient experience here.
You mentioned Tobias Picker, and it reminded me of something else in the book that's so astonishing, that you talked about the drum circle, where the physical act of making music calms the tics and gestures of Tourette's. With Tobias Picker, the long, solitary process of writing music has the same effect.
Yeah, I've seen Tobias sort of almost in a state of almost motionless concentration and focus, sort of composing. But when he's not composing, he may be all over the place. And also, there's a form of mental Tourette's in which one can be distracted. Now, he himself doesn't feel that he is non-Touretic when he composes or conducts or plays the piano, but rather that the energy of Tourette's is being channeled and focused, and itself is providing a special sort of richness. Many people with Tourette's who are also creative will find that in the act of being creative or performing, if you want, the Tourette's is sublimated or focused and becomes a gift rather than a distraction or a disorder.
Anyone who has read any one of your now 10 books, I think, in the company of your books, feels very lucky to be with a great mind and a generous spirit, and all of us tonight have added yet another dimension, which is this time spent with their great and generous author. Oliver, thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.